Thanks for listening to the Adam Carolla Show on Podcast One.
Well, coming up next, D.L. Hughley, or Hughley, depending on if you talk to Mike August or not, but we'll get to the bottom of that. And, you know, he collapsed on stage in Nashville right after I played Nashville. But he's going to tell us a story about collapsing on stage for the very first time 30 years before that he hadn't thought about in a while. So get ready for that. First, I'll tell you about Tommy John, the secret to staying sweat-free this summer. Tommy John's summer-ready, ultra-breathable underwear and bras, cool cotton underwear for men and for women, like having your own on-body AC unit made from premium natural Pima cotton for enhanced airflow. It evaporates sweat super fast. I'm telling you, I do this every night. I wear my Tommy John's. I got my t-shirt. I got my underwear on. I go work out on my rowing machine. I get all sweated up. I just walk around the house. It just air dries. It is so good. They have lounge pants, lazy day joggers, soft Zoom ready Z's and polos as well. Upgrade to Tommy John. Do it today for the most beautiful, breathable designs. Best pair you'll ever wear, or it's free guarantee. Tommy John, no adjustment needed, right, Dawson?
For a limited time, go to TommyJohn.com/Adam to get 20% off site wide. That's TommyJohn.com/Adam for 20% off site wide. TommyJohn.com/Adam. See site for details. I'm your emotional support animal.
It shows just how fucking petrified of the Twitter mob every public figure is nowadays. The fact that they've talked good people who have never harmed anyone into giving preemptive apologies to nut jobs is outrageous.
Written and narrated by Adam Carolla.
Consequently, I'm starting with a warning. I'm not going to apologize for anything in this book.
Pick up a copy now at AdamCarolla.com.
D.L. Hughley is our guest. The book, Surrender, White People, Our Unconditional Terms for Peace. It's available now on Amazon and wherever you get fine books. And I just checked in the political humor category of Amazon. The first five or six spots are all your book and my book. So we just whacked up the first five or six spots up there. So congratulations, D.L. Hughley.
Likewise to you, too. Likewise.
How you feeling? We just put it up on the screen for it.
I feel a lot better. I guess today is my last day of quarantine. I feel a lot better. I actually thought I had it in January of this year, which is why I wasn't so concerned when I went to play those gigs in Texas. Apparently I was wrong. Everybody's doing good. My son is just about done and I'm just about done. So it was an interesting experience.
So I never really got the full story. I know dehydration, exhaustion was one of the things we were talking about, but was that from COVID or do we know how big a role that played?
I went to infectious diseases. I was from Tennessee to Los Angeles, and apparently it's not a known symptom, but if you're dehydrated, it can be a drain on your, any virus can be a drain on your system. And so I was burning the candles at both ends. I had just come from performing previously in Dallas, and then I come back and do my radio show and my TV show. I was a little tired, and then I'd done two shows previously, and then the next night for the second show, because I had like 12 shows scheduled that week. So the next night I just went on stage, and one of the things they tested me for, they confirmed that I was dehydrated and exhausted, they tested me for a battery test, but they tested me for COVID and I came back positive.
I think comedy sometimes is like, it's like sports. You're hurt, but you have so much adrenaline, you don't have time to feel it until after the game when it swells up and whatever. Do you sort of feel that way? Like when you're on stage, you have so much energy and so much, you literally go to the point of passing out.
Literally, I knew that the second show I knew I was going to pass out. Actually, I could tell I had that sensation. But I thought once I get on stage, I'll be all right. Once I get on stage, I'll be all right. Like I guess that's me forming Voltron, but it didn't work out that way. But I think I learned a lot, you know.
Hold on. DL, can you mute your phone, please? So, sorry. So you knew you were going to not make it through that show.
I knew it. And then, you know, I tried anyway. And then, you know, it was so funny because it wasn't funny, but I ended up in the hospital. And when I woke up, you know, they ran all these tests and they came back and they told me I was exhausted. And they asked me, could they run some more? I think a CAT scan to see if I had a blood clot. You know, they was checking me to see if I had a stroke. It was all kind of stuff. And then they said, you know, we want to test you for COVID. And I said, of course. And originally they weren't going to give me my results for 5 days. And I was like, what the hell is that? I need to know, you know, everything that's going on now. Cause I'm not, you know, I want to go back to work basically. So they gave me the rapid test and it was confirmed in a couple of hours. And, that was, you know, then they told me to quarantine and gave me the procedure and ran some more tests for the rest of the stuff. And then I stayed in there for a day and I was home.
Well, we'll jump into the book in a second. I do want to say that for a lot of years, I talked to a guy named Mike August, who I've traveled the world with, literally. Yeah. And he's always said, he would say D.L. Hughley. And I said, it's D.L. Hughley. And he'd say, no, it's Hughley. That's how it used to be. And I'd say, I don't know, Mike. And so we'd always argue about that. And then he'd say he knew you way back when you worked for the L.A. Times and you were playing Comedy Act Theater in South Central.
Yeah, it was out. It was in Regency Rest. It was in Leimert Park. But he was actually with Triad and Bill Gross and all those cats there. So, yeah. He was my very first agent.
Now, was it Hughley back in the day?
You know, I never, it's always been Hughley, but you know, that was the argument. Every time I'd go out on an audition or every time I would book something, it was always Hughley or Hughley, but it has always been Hughley. I don't know, Mike.
He does that all the time. So
the Germans that I used to own us years, centuries ago. So I don't know, but it's always been Hughley.
He was like, so DL worked for the LA Times. He was like a successful guy with the LA Times, like a kind of up and coming young star on the, on the LA Times. And he lived way out and he'd have to commute in to do this club. Hey, Chris, you put all the information on my screen and now it's gone for the club. Why would you do that? But anyway, yeah, and he's saying Sinbad would be there. Mike Epps would be there. Martin Lawrence would be there. Chris Tucker would be there. He would say, Robert Townsend. He would say, Jamie Foxx. Although he wasn't Jamie Foxx back then. He was Jamie.
He had a different name back then, but they all started there. Matter of fact, they booked Living Color there. Whoopi Goldberg had her. HBO special there. We met Martin Lawrence started there. The Wayans boys started there. It was on a Thursday. Robin Harris, of course, hosted. It was before the riots. It was the place to be. And after that, of course, nobody would come down anymore.
He said that like Magic Johnson would be in the crowd, like all these huge celebrities would be. And I was like, I don't know. Eric Bishop is Jamie Foxx's real name. So he's telling me D.L. Hughley, although it's Hughley, D.L. would lived way out of town. He'd go do his thing for the Los Angeles Times, and then he'd drive all the way across town at night to play the club.
Right.
And he said you were more focused on comedy. It's probably why you collapsed on stage the other week. But he said that was a huge expenditure of energy. But let's talk about that time in that club.
I passed out on stage at the Comedy Act Theater 25 years ago, and Jamie Foxx and all of them took me to the hospital then.
Oh, like, really?
At the Comedy Act Theater, I passed out. And I left the LA Times because I was so exhausted. I wasn't getting at that time I didn't know what it was, but it was REM sleep. So they took me off work and I was on long-term disability and I never went back after that. But I passed out on stage then, like almost 30 years ago at the Comedy Theater, and Jamie Foxx and all them cats took me to the hospital. So I just actually remembered that. So I and it was exhausting then. And I was like a kid.
Well, let's talk about that period, because as I was talking to Mike about it, and we've talked about it throughout the years, I thought all those huge names starting off in this one club, it doesn't really exist anymore. Also, I think you work for the Los Angeles Times about the time Shelby Coffey was the editor-in-chief. Yep. I was friends with Shelby. I was his boxing coach.
Yeah.
So I used to train Shelby.
I knew Shelby Coffey, yeah.
So
I did.
How do you get to the Times? What's your job at the Times? And then how do you transition into stand-up?
At first, I started off, you know, I was one of the annoying people that would call you on the phone and try to sell you the newspaper. And then I moved, and it's actually where I met my wife, at the LA Times. So I started out selling newspapers, and then I moved up to detail clerk, and I got married at the LA Times, and I needed some more money, so I moved to detail clerk, and then I moved up to assistant manager, and then I moved up to manager, and then I moved up. I was the youngest and the first black sales manager ever. So I was in charge of what was called the Gold Coast. But how I got the job is that I had never gone to college. So I paid this cat a couple hundred dollars from Long Beach State to write a letter and pretend like I'd gone there. And the cat named Ron Wolf, who was in charge, knew it was bullshit, but he gave me the gig anyway. And he was like, he was integral. So like I would do that. I lived in Kern County, a place called Rosamond. I would drive to Ventura. Then I would drive back from Ventura to Los Angeles to perform at the Comic Theater and all the way back again. So I was getting basically no sleep at all. And in 1 year, I put 85,000 miles on a company car I had. And that, when I passed out, it's so funny, full circle. I passed out doing that. I was so exhausted. I'd gone to UCLA Medical Center then. I passed out. And they said I wasn't getting my REM sleep, and they put me on disability, and I ended up never going back as a result of passing out. And that guy, Ron Wolf, kept my benefits alive for a year and gave me a discretionary bonus, and I just started working the road and never really went back.
Wow. And you really want to go full circle, that first job you had at the Times, calling people and selling them subscriptions to the Los Angeles Times. My wife's mom did that for a living. So she used to just call people all day, you know, and offer them a subscription. So let me just work this triangle out, because I've been trying to think about this for a while. And then also, you had a family at that time, right? I mean, you still do. But what I mean is your wife, you had wife and kids out there, right?
Right. Right.
And
same ones.
Sorry, say it again. Same ones.
I got ones. They won't leave.
So you are going out, like, what, give us the day's schedule, because I'm interested in this and that young people who are listening who want to know how to get ahead. You know, I tell people all the time when they go, I don't have time to do this, or I got a full time job, or I got kids. It's like, hey, you better find time. You better make time.
Right.
So
I would start, because if you know where Kern County is, which is like, it was a place called Rosamond. So I had to drive there to Ventura County, which was an hour and 45 minute ride. And that was talking about without traffic. Then from there, so I had to leave at about, I left about 7 in the morning, went there, worked till 7 at night. From Ventura to Los Angeles, it was an hour and 10 minutes. So I would leave there in the clothes that I wore to work, go to the Comedy Act Theater, play there, and then go back to Rosamond to be with my wife and kids to start all over again. So I was getting like literally 2 or 3 hours sleep for like a year, and which is why I was exhausted too. I remember one point my wife thought I was kidding, so she went on the run with me. She got up and went to work with me, and we had a babysitter, and then she went to the Comedy Act Theater with me. She came home, and on the way home, she started crying because she couldn't believe I'd gone through it. I used to be so sleepy. I used to fall asleep. I used to go... I would drive about 45 minutes. There was a Denny's on the 14 freeway, and with a Denny's and an In-N-Out burger, and it was well lit. So I would fall asleep there for 30, 40 minutes so I could make it the rest of the way home. And I did that every day for like a year, year and a half.
The club that we're talking about, which is Comedy Act Theater, where was that exactly?
It was in Leimert. So it's 43rd and Crenshaw.
And Crenshaw. And that was So it was going off there, like its prime years were early 90s, 91, 92.
The late 80s, early 90s. And then right up until the Rodney King riot, it was all the rage. Like everybody went there. It was like our cotton club. Everybody. You would see the biggest actors in the world go there. And because it was such a comedy hotspot, that's why Mike August and Bill Gross came down there. And that's where they signed everybody. Like Robert Townsend, Sinbad, everybody, the Wayans boys, Eddie Murphy used to come through all the time. Eddie Murphy, and when he was at his height, Robin Harris started roasting Eddie Murphy so bad Eddie left. Like Robin Harris, like it was the ultimate, and everybody you know and love now, all the black acts you know and love now later on become superstars. I remember Dave Chappelle would come out, and he was like a kid. So it was just where we started out, and then it pretty much went away. Like after the Rodney King burgers and the riots and all that area burned down, then you know, of course, the agents and the industry went away from there.
The riots were in 93, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So
early 90s.
You're there in 92 or a little bit before then. Right. And
about 89.
And so where did you get your motor? Where did this, did it get instilled in you, or was it always just sort of in you?
I'd always worked hard. Like I never graduated from college, and I knew I wasn't gonna, I never graduated from high school. So I knew I had, and my wife was like, hey, you know, I got married. I was a kid and I got married and we started having kids right away. And there was, and she didn't, she would, she, you know, she was staying home with the kids. So I had to hustle to make it happen. So that was never a thing to me. That was never, that was what I'd always done. But I've actually never played the comedy store. Never. And I remember the first time I ever got booked, I used to play the Comedy Act Theater and I would play the Birdland West. And I never played the first time I ever played a mainstream comedy club was the Improv in Cleveland. And it was right after the big Def Jam thing. And it was a door deal. They would say, we'll give you 90% of the door. And they charged everybody $30. And I remember making so much money, but they used to, you know, they looked at us as Def Jam act. So we weren't mainstream. So it was the first time. And that had to be 95 or 90 where I'd ever played any room other than an urban room. And then, you know, of course, after that, you know, between that, there was Def Jam and, you know, then I did the BET Comic View and then, you know, got the show and Kings of Comedy and all that kind of stuff came subsequently. But the Comedy Act Theater was all where it all started.
Yeah, I know what it's like when you grow up poor, and I grew up in Los Angeles. I know you grew up in Los Angeles and poor, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
And then they go, well, we'll give you 90% of the door. And then they go, we sold out the first show. You want to add a second show on Thursday? And you go, yeah, man, do it. Because you're used to getting $8 an hour. And then they go, they sold out the second. You want to add a third? Right. And you go, go ahead, man. Like, just keep adding it on.
Right. That's what, and that actually what happened in Tennessee, Nashville, Brian Dorfman, you know, Zany's, you know, all the clubs had been closed forever. So I was in a rush to get back. We had 12 shows booked and they were all sold out. Because that's just the gig. That's what I up until, this is the longest I've never been on stage. I've been on stage every week for decades. Well, if I were 3 or 4 weeks a year, it would be amazing. So everybody who knows me, it's just always the way I've been. Even when I had the series, we were doing Kings of Comedy, whether I'm doing a movie, whether I'm doing a radio show, no matter what, even with the TV show that we're doing now, I still get on the road every weekend.
Well, let's talk about that, because I talked to a few comedians about it. I think I was talking to Brian Callen about it. And I said, you know, I went out to the...
I said, Brian.
Oh, Brian. I said, I did his podcast, and I said, I went out to the Houston Improv. I'd been off for 3-4 months. I thought there was going to be a lot of ring rust, and I kind of got right back up where I left off. It didn't... Right. Diminished that much. I was kind of surprised because everyone's always like, you got to work out every night, otherwise it falls off quick. But how did you feel getting back on stage?
I actually felt Dallas. I did like 10 shows, so you know, I wasn't rusty, but I was tired. You know, I was tired, like you know, because you know, doing 3 shows a night every night for 3 or 4 nights in a row is, you know, it was tiring, but. it felt, you know, I could never imagine a time like this, and I don't know that anybody's ever seen a time like this, where what you love to do has just been taken away from you like that overnight. Like, it just, I went, you know, and not just me, obviously, and I'm not, you know, sure people have it a lot worse than that, but you went from having your calendar book for the next year and a half to, you know, the way that you lived and your way of life, and all of a sudden it doesn't exist anymore. And that there is no way of that level of getting back to that level of normalcy, that I don't know that we'll ever get back there, but that's a very sobering thought. So I was taking all that in, but I was as sharp comedically as I was, cause there was so much to talk about, but I was very tired.
Do you have something? We're about the same age, and the more I go through life, the more I start thinking about, well, what do I want to do? Like, I've written a few books, I made a few documentaries and that kind of stuff.
Your last was very dope. It was the one on what was it, the Netflix one you just did.
Uppity? And I was shocked.
Yeah, with that. And I had him on my TV show, The Race. I had him on my TV.
You had Willie T.
Willie T on my TV
Willie
show.
Willie T ripped, yeah.
Matter of fact, the day before I flew to Nashville, I had him on my TV show. I'd done an interview with him, and I had watched your documentary. I'd done the interview, and then all the whole Bubba Watson thing. It was like a weird kind of synergistic thing, and how they kind of just mirrored those experiences, you know, 30, 40 years ago are still kind of what's happening now in that realm.
Yeah, Willie, I love Willie T. He's a great character.
And
he's a great character. And he, you know, we found him. I was doing a doc on Paul Newman's racing history and found the Willie T story in the middle of the Paul Newman documentary. And so when we were shooting, we were finishing the Paul Newman doc, I said the next doc we have to do is Willie, who I was aware of. But I didn't know that much about him, so we took a deep dive into Willie T. And hopefully that is going to move to Showtime in a episodic television series.
It was a very well done documentary, and it was funny because you're a comic, so I didn't see I didn't see that coming. Like, I was like, okay, well, I remember that whole thing, and I remember finding out that you did it. I was like, whoa, okay, that makes sense. That makes sense.
Well, you know, that's the whole thing. In a way, we have a lot in common because we write books, we do commentary, we also do jokes and stand-up, yeah. TV shows, radio. You know, you're kind of a Swiss Army knife of entertainment, and I'm sort of a Swiss Army knife of entertainment. But and you make some features and that kind of stuff. Well, so what about you? What would you like to do that you're not doing or next?
Well, you know, it was funny. I'd written a book previous to this one called How Not to Get Shot, and we'd optioned it, and we were gonna start making it. It was a 5-part series. And so, of course, COVID hit, and now hopefully we'll get back to that, because we were actually supposed to start shooting in March when, of course, production and stuff closed down. But I love doing the radio show. I love doing my TV talk show. I love writing books. I'm writing a new book now called Predisposed, which is all about the ways, like, every time something happens to Black people in general, it's always kind of their fault. Like, I remember the Surgeon General was talking about how we died disproportionately, but blamed, you know, it on the fact that we were predisposed to, you know, diabetes and heart disease and all that kind of stuff. So I've always taken things that I was interested in and tried to either flush them out comedically but I really like writing books a lot more than I thought I would. It's four books later, I guess I found out that I really enjoy it, and that it just, it's like, to me, it's all the same thing. Like, whether it's writing jokes or doing a movie or doing the radio show, it's like water comes into your house, same source, different users. Some you take a shower with, or wash clothes with, or you cook with, but it really is the same wellspring. It's the same source. So that's kind of how I kind of approach it. It's like, what, because the wellspring is my perspective, And so whatever that applies to, it's just kind of what I'm in. I want to do now the things that I'm very interested in doing, and that's what I get to do. So I'm very blessed that way.
Yeah, there's a saying, I don't know what it is, Chris, if you can find it or not, but there's a saying that sort of goes, I'm going to paraphrase, if you want to know what you're thinking or how you think or whatever, write. Like if you write, that's how you'll know. It's kind of hard when you're on stage, you're trying to make the audience laugh or you've got a mic in your mouth and you're interviewing somebody or something like that, but if you really just want to know where you're at and how your brain works and what you're thinking about, then you write in whatever's on that paper, sort of where you're at. It's
pretty true. And, you know, and it's in many forms. Like I write a lot on Twitter. I like the reason I like social media, period, is because the expediency of it. It's like you get to have these, you know, before to say something stupid, you had to wait, but now you can do it at 2 o'clock in the morning. But I like having a thought and putting it out in the zeitgeist. I like having and I love reading more than I ever thought I would. Oh, I guess I am old now, but I love reading more than I thought I would. I love reading different perspectives. I like one of the great things that happened during this whole COVID thing is that I watched more documentaries and read more books than I ever would have or ever believed would be interesting. And like I watched The Tiger King and I learned a lot. Like I would have never watched it, but I learned that if you pet a tiger long enough, pretty soon you're going to fuck a dude. I know that. And you'll but all these things that I never would have had time or never would have believed I was interested in, I found so interesting. Like even watching your interview and watching various documentaries on different artists and different art forms and just where people's minds are and reading things I never thought that I would. If I started writing more, it wouldn't be the worst thing.
Well, you know, it sounds like I was just talking to someone about this the other day, which is there's so many people, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you tell me. I feel like, oh my God, there's so much out there. I want to consume it. I want to put it out there. I want to know about everything. I want to taste every meal. I want to write on every subject. I want to travel to every country. I want to lay down with every woman. So you
hang on.
Your wife's in there. So my thing is like, and then other people just want to binge watch their favorite TV show and have a Pop-Tart and go to bed. Do you feel like, I feel like as you're getting older, you're realizing, you know, time is limited. There's so much I want to do and there's nothing that can stop me from doing it. Is that a fair statement?
You know what? My daughter is married. My wife, my kids are happy. My son is in a relationship. My homes are paid off. I got a gig I love. My wife and I, you know, are in love and it's funny and cool. But I spent a very long time doing things. Now, I've always loved what I've done, but to be honest, it was connected. There was a goal. I had to work to take care of a family, and so a lot of the things that I did, I don't know whether I talked myself into, the idea that I liked them, or if it was just organic. But now, I only want to do things I want to do. Like, I don't want to go places. Like, I only want to do the things that I'm very interested in. I want to have the conversations, to your point, that I'm interested in. I want to read the things that I'm interested in. And it's such a varied palette now. There are things that I would have never thought would be interesting to me. There are things that I eat now that I never would have thought would have been interesting to me. Like, I think the world probably, because you got to remember the world was on lockdown at the same time. And I think either people went one way or the other, either they went in or they went out. And I think if you have gone in that experience, if you've been in that experience and it was a very shared experience and you don't come out different, I think it was a waste.
Yeah, no, I agree. I feel that. If you are devastated because somebody breaks up with you or you get fired from a job you love or even if sometimes, God forbid, you get in a horrible car accident, it all sounds really negative, but you should be able to find something in that, some growth, some learning, some perspective that changed when you learned how to appreciate something that you didn't learn how to, you formerly didn't appreciate. And so it's sort of like I used to say at the beginning of this, you know, you can do the time or the time can do you. So you do the time. Don't let the time do you. You know, right. you can
they
get
say it. That yeah, you're absolutely right. Yeah.
Yeah. I was like, if you're going to, you can go to prison for 6 months and come out with a great book or a tattoo on your forehead and a venereal disease. You know what I mean?
Like, they can be both.
Or both. Yeah. The quote was, if you want to know what you look like, look into a mirror. If you want to know how you think, you should write. And that was a quote I was trying to think of from a man named Dennis Prager. So let's talk about the current political climate, the situation, race relations, all that. What are your thoughts on what's going on right now? And
I think it's very precarious. I think I would say it would be fair to say that there hasn't been this level of social upheaval and even awareness since the 60s. And I think this is our approximation of it. And I think, and I talked about this earlier, but I think that there were a lot of reasons for this. I think that the fact that the country by and large was devoid of distractions and couldn't, you know, there was so that everybody, we had the nation's, you know, the nation's rapt attention. And then there was sequentially these things that people just couldn't turn away from and had to, they were forced to see. And it really did. It really was the mirror that you talked about earlier. And I think that a lot of people saw things in themselves and in this country that made them uncomfortable and spurred them to action. And I think just, you know, we were talking about NASCAR earlier and the fact that NASCAR openly says Black Lives Matter. It's like we were on lockdown so long, when we came out, Black lives started to matter. And I don't know how, I'm sure that is very fragile and very precarious and very tenuous, but I am very optimistic that people are starting to see and do things in ways they previously wouldn't have been open to. And so that gives me hope. But I think in America, there's always this dichotomy. Like you'll have people who are, you know, rightfully appalled by what they saw happen to George Floyd and want justice and that officer to be punished. But some of those same people will fight for monuments and statues of men who did far worse to Black people.
Yeah. Well, my feeling is I could do it sort of case by case, like show me a monument, show me what side of the Civil War he was on, show me what his history was, and we could do it case by case. That doesn't mean all of them or none of them. How do you feel about policing or strategies toward policing or defund or any of those subjects?
You're right. I agree with something you said earlier about case by case, but the problem is about the statues and what they mean. It isn't most of these statues are men who were traitors to the country and were brutal to Black people. They got statues just for that.
Right.
They didn't know. You can't, you know, we should name military bases after dudes who lost.
Right. I agree. Yeah, no, that's a good point.
there is a statue right now in New York of a man who's called the father of modern gynecology. And he performed gynecological surgeries on enslaved Black women with no anesthesia. Why does he need a statue? Why is there statues to people that just started the Klan? Like, America has a lot of statues of men whose only claim to fame is they were brutal to Black people. That's what they did. And the last dude who got a statue who wasn't brutal to Black people was Apollo Creed. And he beat this. It was Rocky, and he beat it out of Apollo. No, but I don't think that willy nilly you should tear people down, but tear statues down. But I think if your history is connected to such wanton brutality, that says more about you. Why you want to keep that says more about what you believe we have to do to move forward than it does about me. And in terms of policing, I think no one. When I hear defund the police, I think that it is. It's much like our how America spends so much money on our military prowess and not on anything else. And I don't think that we need to spend so much money being the biggest, baddest motherfuckers on earth. And because when that is what you do, then sooner or later you want to find a reason to use those weapons that you have invested in. And I think policemen are the same way. I don't think that policemen need to be called out for homeless people or people with mental problems. I think that we put a lot on them that they are not necessarily equipped to handle, that they can't be society's dirty clothes hamper. But also, I think that they shouldn't be able to have qualified immunity. I don't think that anybody should. I think that, you know, Derek Chauvin, who killed George Floyd, had 18 complaints against him. 18. The only people, the only profession where you can have 18 complaints by the public and still keep your job are priests and policemen.
Yeah. If you're driving for Uber, you're out.
That's really it. And so why do you get a special dispensation? The matter of fact, your calling, because your calling is so you have a higher calling. You should have, it should be a higher standard, not a lower one. You should have people to answer to. And I think qualified immunity gives people the idea that they're untouchable, that they're above the law. And those people tend to be the ones who are in our communities. And we see these things play out over and over again. And I think that there's the idea of policing in America needs to change, because it always, what they're doing now is what they always have done, which is to keep black people in places where they don't, out of places where they don't belong and where they do.
You're politically oriented, obviously. You must have been approached to run for office or discussed it. Had to come up before.
That doesn't interest me at all. But I will say this. I'm very interested in how we navigate this arena that we're in, because the thing that I find the most disturbing, I think the country, the way that Derek Chauvin stood on that man's neck, knowing that he was killing him, and that there was no sense of urgency, there was no anger, there was no sociopaths do that.
Oh yeah.
And the fact that he knew nothing would happen, and that he was committing murder in front of everybody, and he knew nothing would happen, says a lot about this nation, and that happens often.
I have a few thoughts. I don't think it's as often. Well, what I should say is a lot of white people get killed by cops as well. It's not really reported on as much, but doesn't mean there's not killer cops out there. It just means they're doing way too much killing of white and black and brown. My theory with that cop runs a little bit deeper, which is, he had people around him, black people, I'm assuming, saying, get off the guy. And he stayed on every time they said, you're killing him, he can't breathe, get the fuck off him. He went, you're going to tell me what to do? I'm staying here. Like, I felt like he was going against the crowd.
I feel like he's trying to murder him.
But you think if they were alone and nobody was around filming or anything, think he would have done the exact same behavior?
I think the fact that he wasn't alone and the fact that he knew he was being taped leads credence to the idea that he knew what he was doing. And he had 18 incidences of violence. He shot a kid early. This is who he is, and this is who this society protects. And those men are the type of men who are rife in our communities. Yes, white men get shot more than black men do, black and brown men, by the police. But they also shoot more policemen. They shoot away many more policemen than black or brown people do. And where that dichotomy changes, where that dynamic changes, there are many more unarmed black men and brown men who get killed by the police than white men.
Well,
many.
Now, statistically, I heard 10 last year.
10 what?
10 unarmed black men shot by cops in, I don't know, 2019 or something like that.
We can probably name, just off the top, the kid killed in Aurora last year for the ski mask, the kid who's McClain, Botham John, who they walked into his apartment, killed him. Tatiana Jefferson, they killed her in her apartment. Breonna Taylor, they killed her on that raid just now in Louisville. We had
You don't have to. I mean,
but I'm saying
I know even, there's a lot. We don't have to. It's a lot. Figure it all out.
It's a lot more than 10. And I just think if you look at what we're going back to, the kid that got killed in Aurora, Illinois, he had a ski mask on. He had what my son has. He had the Asperger syndrome. They thought he was he was being disrespectful wearing a ski mask. He was an introvert. They basically they put him in a chokehold, think he's on drugs, give him a drug to stop an overdose, and he has a heart attack and dies.
Yeah. No, look, I'm not defending cops. It's horrible.
No. And here's the thing. I think one of the things that I always am repulsed by is they have a hard job. No one could deny that. But if it's too hard that society has to suffer, don't do it. You don't have to do that job.
Where do you come down on education, family, and that sort of stuff? I think there's a lot of family involved here. I feel like the black family is almost destroyed. We need to build it back up. I'm not sure what the avenue is to build the black family back up. And by the way, every family, I think we're suffering from that as a nation, certainly statistically. Take a kid from a broken family and expect them to succeed. It's so much more difficult. What can we do to remedy that?
I think that one of the things, and it was funny because I actually was having this conversation with Vice President Biden a couple of days ago.
But oh, really?
One of the things that's interesting about education is there's never been a time in America where America invested in black and brown people's education. They gave them schools, and those schools were often inferior. They didn't build new schools and give them books or the modern equipment. You got the relics of what somebody else left behind. So this idea that we have invested in America's in black and brown people's education is a fallacy.
How did the Pence conversation come about?
No, Biden, not Pence.
Oh, sorry, Biden. Sorry, I was thinking of Vice President. He probably broke up. Sorry, Biden.
He called to see how I was doing and if I was on the mend, and we started talking about what he believed was important, what I believe was important. And one of the things we came to was education. And I think what's very interesting to me is this notion that we will spend more, obviously, on penalizing people than educating them. And that the notion that just because you spent a lot of money, like name me a time in our history where we were given adequate schooling, just adequate schooling. That whole separate but equal notion of this America's was that we'll have these schools and you can have these schools we're not using anymore and these resources we're not using anymore. So there was never equal footing. And I think ultimately there needs to be an opportunity for people to succeed or fail at a basic level, at a basic level where we make real investments in modern education. My children went to school when I started making money. They went to school at a school district in Los Angeles, Inglewood School District. And it was a great school. And then we moved to the Valley. And my children were so far behind when we got here, up and from the time that they got up to there when they was, 4, 5, and 6 years old, to the time they left, I had to hire tutors to catch them up. So imagine that replicating itself all over the country.
Yeah.
And I just,
where'd you go in the Valley? Where'd they go in the Valley?
The West Hills, Palmelo Elementary, and I forgot the name of the school. So I moved to West Hills, and then later on I moved to Calabasas, and they went to El Camino, and my daughter went on to Smith and USC. My children have all graduated from college, but I always had to pay take resources and pay for tutors just to catch them up because they had started out in a school in the inner city.
There's a story, I think, of a black radio show host, conservative, named Larry Elder. And the story goes that he went to school in Crenshaw and was thought he was doing pretty good. And then at some point ended up at Fairfax High School and was immediately way behind everyone. And that shit's from the 60s, probably 60s, you know, early 70s. Your daughter's from the 2000s and beyond. So this is a pretty old story. What do you think about family? What do we do?
I think that the notion of family, I think this idea that there's anything people could do, that seems to be more inherent. People have to either have a level of value and appreciate for it. But I think families look differently. Like there is the popular notion that black men tend to be absentee fathers. But even sociologists say that black parents, black men are as involved with their children in terms of reading to them, taking them to school, giving them baths, taking them to a doctor's appointment as any other group of parents. And more so than society would have you believe. Because they're not married to that woman doesn't mean they're not an active participant in that child's life. But the popular notion of that, you know, the society's popular notion is that, you know, we're all absent and we're not fathers, which isn't a lot of that is a stigma. A lot of that is, you know, people's personal experiences. And of course, that gets exacerbated and you concentrate more on negative than you do on positive. But the idea of family has to be inherent and important to that individual. But I think the structure has to find ways to be like the referee and stay out of the way and to make it easier to stay a family, to make it easier, like to have a man that feels like he's accomplished in something, to have children that feel like they're learning things, to have a person feel fulfilled. There are things that we can do to make sure that you can provide an atmosphere that's conducive to family staying together, or to their motivation. But I don't know there has to be a level of that's inherent too.
What was your family of origin like?
My father was the hardest working man I've ever met. My mother was an interesting woman, and I had two sisters and a brother, and we grew up on 135th in Avalon. And my father
is that South Central?
It is. So if you threw a rock from where I live, you'd hit somebody that lives in Compton. So it was interesting. So but watching the things, like I remember when I grew up, you remember Proposition 13, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So when I grew up, we used to have buses and after school programs and free lunch programs. And when Proposition 13 happened, all that stuff was taken away. So my neighborhood had to go to Gardena High, but we had to, when the buses were taken away, we had to walk through all these neighborhoods, these other neighborhoods, to go to school. And after a while, you getting your ass whooped every day and fighting every day. All the dudes who could fight dropped out. So sooner or later, you're going to school with nerds and people in the band. So that shit that's not work. But flash to that event, which they attached to, you know, to property value. That event, if you look at that and watch what happened as a result of that, how crime spiked and violence spiked and drugs spiked, because you took the resources that people used to have and didn't, and LA turned into the Wild Wild West during that time. But it was direct.
Yeah, I went to North Hollywood High, and I think we definitely had kids bust in from Crenshaw and South Central and all that. They played all the skilled positions on the football teams, and the white guys blocked, basically, is how it worked. I mean, I played football with guys named Melvin Royal, and and all these cats from probably South Central and Crenshaw and stuff like that. And they all they all bust in, and I lived next door to North Hollywood High, so I just jumped the fence, go back right to my house, and I used to see that bus would pick them up on Chandler Boulevard. They'd all line up at about 5 o'clock, and because after football practice, you know, they couldn't go home after school, they had to go home after football practice. Let's see, Mario Menefee. I'm thinking of some of these names. There was I'll come up with some more of these good black names for you. Try not to be offended, but there was.
Why would I be offended by a dude's name?
I don't know. These are very touchy times, DL. I don't want to offend. Wendell Shirley, who changed it to Wendell Shirley. I'm trying to think of some of the other brothers, and they would get in that bus at 5 o'clock, and I'd be like, "Shit, I'm going home," and I'll be home in 10 minutes. And they're like, "Those guys got a long ride back to wherever they came from," and then they'd also have to get in the bus at 6:30 in the morning to make it. Again, my class was 8:05. I'd wake up at 7:45 and just jump the fence and be sitting in there. So I always took note that was kind of a long day for those guys.
Yeah. Imagine when that didn't happen anymore. Like, because what they did, they took resources away, and every, you know, the drug game got bad. Gangs got bad. You know, like if you took a line and drew it from that huge spike of crime, like, it wasn't that big a long a period of time between Proposition 13 and the riots of Rodney King. Mm-hmm. I bet you when gangs were rampant, drugs were rampant. But imagine that exacerbating itself all over the city, where the rich got richer and the poor got poor, and the resources went away. And then you had three strikes and you're out. And then you had all these drug laws. And then but all of this was about a society that was punitive and short-sighted, and it got to a place where California couldn't afford to jail all those people anymore. So they let 20,000 people out as a result. And I guarantee you, all those people, if you look at their trajectory, it was this minimizing of resources that were in a community, and people got their, you know, the test of their property value, and all of a sudden, L.A. became a city that was, you know, violent and drug-addled and you know, the police, we spent more on policing, and it didn't have the desired result. I guarantee you.
I don't know.
People would have done a different thing.
You said your dad was the hardest working guy you've ever met. So obviously that seemed to work on you. Did it have that effect on your brothers and your sister as well?
They work hard. They're just dumb. No, they work hard. They work hard. They just have a different outlet. They have a different idea of the world than I do. And I'd always had a specific. I remember my ideas used to always get me whoopings and kicked out of school and beat up. And so I grew up learning that there was a consequence to saying what you believed and standing on it. I knew that it resulted in generally an ass whooping. And so after a while, it became something I was kind of used to.
Did your parents stay together? Are they still alive? Yeah.
No, I just lost my old man about 3 years ago, but yeah, it'd be 3 years next 3 years. This in a couple of days, actually. But yeah, he died of lung cancer, and my mother's still alive. Yes.
And they stayed together till the end of your father's life.
If together by living in the same house.
Yeah.
Yeah, they lived in the same domicile, yes.
I get it. What business was your dad in?
He cleaned airplanes for first Western Airlines, and then first Western, and then later on became Delta. And I remember my father got a gold watch for never being late.
Wow.
Never. He never was late, and he threw it on the dresser, and he was like, like very dismissive. Like he was like, "Hey, I don't care about that watch." And it was in a case, and it was so. One day, I was like, "This motherfucker don't care about the watch." So I put it on one day, and he saw me with it on and beat the shit out of me. Like he pretended like that watch wasn't a big deal, but it really was everything to him. And I learned a lot specifically about his assessment of his worth and what we would think of that. And I always, whenever, even flashed to me passing out, I believe that a man is supposed to work till he can't work anymore. And I got that from him. And I think now it's starting to be detrimental, but that's an idea he instilled in me.
I feel the same way, though my dad didn't instill anything in me, but I found it somewhere. The book, Surrender, White People, Our Unconditional Terms for Peace, and it's available now on Amazon, and you can also watch TV show D.L. Hughley Uncut. New episodes are Friday, 8 p.m. on Pluto TV, channel 428. I have a channel on Pluto TV as well, so you can watch D.L. and you can watch us, too. Website. Sorry.
Oops. I said we got a text.
Oh, you broke up. Sorry, DL. Say it again.
I said we have a tag team thing going.
Yeah, I'm on. I think mine is Chassis. Uppity, I think. And a lot of these car, a lot of my car docs are on 585. DL is 428. And the website, realdlhughley.com, is where you go. Hey, DL, thanks for doing this.
Thank you, man. I had a good time. Thank you, man.
I had a good time, too, and we'll talk soon, I hope. And don't work too hard.
No, I won't. Thank you, man. Thank you.
All right. You can go to AdamCarolla.com for all you need, and you can get my book right next to DL's book on Amazon as well. Until next time, it's Adam Carolla for Bald Brian and Gina and DL Hughley. Oh, good sports coming up next. Saying mahalo.
Stick around. Dave Damashek and Adam Carolla return for Good Sports right after this.
Good Sports. It's time for a sports segment. It's time for Ace and Dave. It's time to get it started.
NFL highlights. Mixed martial arts fights.
Riffing on bad stuff on movies. Breaking the fruits of the year. Danger recapping hockey.
Good sports.
Ace is getting talking.
Good sports.
Shooting jerks with blasters.
Good sports.
Nasally podcasters.
Good sports.
Ace and Shecky, let's do it. Good sports.
The Podcast One Sports Network presents Good Sports.
Hi and hello, sports fans. It is time once again to not just survive, but to thrive here on Good Sports. Dave Damashek here. Adam Carolla over there. What's the poop, fella? How are you?
I'm doing well, David. Thanks Excellent. For having me.
Well, it's your thing. But anyway, all right. Either way, Ace, you know, it occurred to me because I'm vain and so things that pertain to me are of interest to me. And my birthday was just a few days back, June 11th. And I've always celebrated the fact that I'm surrounded by great names in the world of sports and beyond. And then I looked up yours, May 27th, correct?
Correct.
I don't know what we can glean from this about either one of us, but you might be the best May 27th birthday haver that I can find. Are you aware? Have you ever looked it up, who you share a birthday with?
It comes up every once in a while. It may be, I have heard it a few times, but I can't really recall. I don't know why. Maybe Prince for some reason pops into my head, but I don't know. This is
Prince, really?
I don't know. Gary's going to look it up. Here's what you get. You get one rock star and then one high-ranking Nazi official. You know what I mean? That kind of evens
it
out.
So true. Yeah. Admiral Jacques blah, 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 blah. Like, who is that? Oh, yeah. I see it. He was relevant in the 17th century in Spain. Yes.
No, what you get is, I'm saying you get the great evener, which is like you go, you go, hey, you know, my birthday is, it's Eric Clapton. We have the same birthday and Goering too, or Goebbels or whoever, like the pick one, some high ranking Nazi official. And then that evens it out. You see what I'm saying? That's all. That's all you need to tell your kid about life. You know what I mean? Like, your birthday is going to be the same as, you know, Hans Christian Andersen and then Tex Watson from the Manson family. You know what I mean? Like, that's how life works. That's why you can't pay attention to it.
It's so funny you say that, because I've always kind of regarded it as a, like, a can't miss kind of thing, looking at who you share a birthday with, because it usually makes you feel a little bit better, whether it's rational or not. Kind of like a fortune cookie. I've always said, like, how much stock, when people actually put stock in what the fort, hey, I'm going to save this one. This one's pretty good. Like, until they start mixing in, like, hey, pretty good chance you're going to be dead soon. Like, you know, like, until those are some of the fortunes available to you, then I can't really take them very seriously. But I've kind of, you make a good point. And actually, your own birthday kind of turns me around on that. Do you share birthday with, this is as good as it gets, Louis Gossett Jr. Okay, he won an Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor, of course, Officer and a Gentleman. But not a, then again, not held up there as one of the great legends of
right,
of cinema. You got Paul Bettany, same thing that would describe him. His greatest achievement, he's married to perhaps the most beautiful woman in the history of film. I can't think of her name, but
Gina Lola Brigida.
That's it. That's the one. I can't. What is her name? She was in the, I can't think of her name. But anyway,
Jennifer Connelly.
Yes. All right. Jack McBrayer, the character actor, of course, from 30 Rock. And then maybe the best one of the group is Andre 3000 from Outkast. That's
really
about it, though. That's about it. I cannot find any actor of, I mean, athlete of note related to you. Oh, you do share.
Gary says something.
There's a decent actor, Richard Schiff, who's probably most famous from The West Wing.
Yeah. Right. But that's not gonna delight my daughter and her friends.
No.
Corolla, I really have to say, you know, to this reporter's eyes, I think the name Adam Corolla jumps ahead of Richard Schiff, certainly. The other one out there is, of course, Arnold's older brother in Different Strokes, Todd Bridges. Who do you think's older, Ace?
Me or Todd?
Yeah.
I seem to recall knowing Todd or running into Todd like back in the day and him being a couple of years younger than me. So I'm going to say,
I think he's 1 year younger than you. I think that's correct.
But, you know, we used to play the same name game, who was like, mm-hmm, same last name, who could be further apart. And, you know, in a way, there should be a birthday game, which is who. OK, so who has the most range? It's like I said, like, who has Albert Einstein and Hitler? You know what I mean? Like, who has the most range? Like, you look at mine, there's no range there, you know?
Not really, no.
Nobody, there's no big difference between Lou Gossett. I mean, in who do you have who's tried to, you know, some people are going to have Stalin and Tom Hanks. You know what I mean?
The biggest, yeah. I love the range game.
Right.
That's fun. You know,
Gary,
what?
Hold on. Gary's raising his hand. He's found some range.
I got a good range one here.
Hmm.
Carmen Electra, George Takei, Joey Lawrence, Hitler.
Wow. That's good. See?
I actually was thinking about a similar game that maybe we can play someday. It's like golf handicaps. I don't know if you know how they work, but like, you throw out your best score, or maybe your top three best scores and your three worst scores to kind of find the middle, mm-hmm, of what your average is. That's true of actors too. Like, the biggest range in terms of like high end iconic film, and then the biggest garbage you've ever seen. It might be De Niro off the top of my head, because he made a lot of money grab pictures late in his career.
Well, Gary, with this new game, you have to look up Jeffrey Dahmer's birthday, Stalin's birthday, the guy who owns Chick-fil-A, all the evil, notorious, you know, folks of our time. And then you have to find out what celebrities, because that's, you know, you got Joey Lawrence, whoa, And then you got Hitler. Like, who are you gonna who are you gonna beat? Who's gonna beat Joey Lawrence in Hitler in the range?
I got a good one for you. Mm. Ashley Benson, Christina Aguilera, Billie Eilish, Brad Pitt, and Stalin.
Wow. Brad Pitt and Stalin.
I gotta lay this one on you. Yes. I don't have evil personified on this list here, but you want to talk about life range. Here you go. Ready now. Joe Montana, the 1A best quarterback of all time at worst. Vince Lombardi, the 1A greatest coach or up there at least. Gene Wilder, the most underrated comedy legend of all time. Paradox notwithstanding, to call him an underrated legend. Henry Hill, of course, the gangster portrayed by Liotta. Peter Dinklage, Jacques Cousteau, and to bring it on home, Ace, and with a rhyme no less, your beloved Cousteau to Adrian Barbeau.
Wow.
And, oh, let me add one more to that list. Dave Damashek. Wow. Beat that list. Beat that list, world. You can't. That's the best. Oh, and also Shia LaBeouf. You ain't going to beat that list. I mean, think about
God,
the
your
range
list
of that
is
list.
So much better than my list. I got Todd
it is
Bridges.
Embarrassing. It's embarrassing, Ace. It's a dead heat between you and Andre 3000. I'm up against Montana and Lombardi and Cousteau.
Here's a hypothetical. Has Montana, when people ask him, who do you share a birthday with, ever brought up Dave Damashek's name?
We're both legends in the world of sports, and we both hail from the greater Pittsburgh area.
Gary has one more.
I have one more. Let's see here. Notorious B.I.G., Mr. T, Jeffrey Dahmer.
Wow. A lot of range. I mean, Mr. T, arguably one of the greatest Americans ever to lace up the boxing gloves, and then Jeffrey Dahmer.
I don't know if anybody's ever had better name characters than B.A. Baracus and Clubber Lang. I mean, that's pretty good. And then his real name is better than both of those.
Right.
That's pretty good, too. But anyway, go ahead, please.
All right, let me hit BetOnline. No shortage of action at BetOnline.ag. Sports, they're coming back. UFC's back. NASCAR is back. Boxing back. Sadly, soccer's back. But, hey, half the world loves it, man. BetOnline has the best odds and lines of upcoming games, and you need more. BetOnline has simulated NFL, NBA, UFC daily. Also, live casino games, poker tournaments, best props in the business. Visit BetOnline.ag. Use your mobile device. Use the promo code PODCAST1. Sign up for your bonus, and you go to Podcast One, you get your sign-up bonus. You visit betonline.ag, our exclusive partner at Podcast One. Don't forget, promo code Podcast One to get that bonus. Do it today. BetOnline, your online sportsbook experts.
I don't know what the bet would be, but I bet no one out there listening to Good Sports right now can drop a line with the hashtag Good Sports by this time next week and let us know anybody who's got a rangier birthday than Dave Damashek has on June 11th. Anywho, we'll revisit that with your tweets and otherwise. But in the meantime, a new Good Sports coming at you tomorrow. Check it out. Until then, for Adam Carolla, Dave Damashek, Good Sports out.
Follow the Adam Carolla Show on Twitter at Adam Carolla Show. Follow Ace on Twitter at Adam Carolla. Leave us a voicemail at 888-634-1744. Pick up Adam's new book, I'm Your Emotional Support Animal. It's available everywhere at adamcarolla.com.